year, all I asked for was a longer ski pant. And year after year, those changes were never made.
The effort, you know, the sense of urgency, the difficulty, doesn't change. I've gotten smarter in how I can approach things, how I can structure things, who I can put around me.
So I started organizing all my ideas by how happy I would be if it worked. I didn't think I could do it. And one of my premises is that the only way I could find my limits was to pick the most motivating thing in the world and just give it everything I've got and see how far I could get.
This is the ProCo 360 podcast. I'm Dave Tabor, hosting ProCo 360 because I love Colorado and I love getting to know the leaders of Colorado's most interesting and entrepreneurial companies. Today's episode is special. It's with my friends at Denver Ventures with a live audience. There you go. David Pritchard and the Denver Ventures team invited me to have conversations with three very successful entrepreneurs who will join me for this episode. I'll have about 15 minutes with each of them, and then there'll be about a 15-minute conversation with all of us together and with audience Q&A. Ankur over there is going to have a microphone, so the Q&A is actually going to be part of that podcast produced. So if you have a question as we kind of wrap, come on up over to Ankur, and he'll give you the mic. So I'll be speaking with three entrepreneurs. First is Kylie McKinnon, who's a former Olympic freestyle skier and now CEO of Half Days. She co-founded Half Days to provide women with a better fitting option for ski apparel and to disrupt the male-dominated outdoor industry. Then I'll be joined by Chris Peterson, who's co-founder of Logrhythm, which in 2021 was valued at $2.4 billion. Chris exited Logrhythm and is now co-founder and CEO of Radical, a company providing cybersecurity defense to small and medium-sized businesses. And third will be Blake Scholl, founder and CEO of Boom Supersonic, the company we've all heard is working to bring back supersonic passenger air travel by 2029. They've raised an astounding $700 million. So, question, what does an outdoor gear company for women, a cybersecurity company, and a supersonic jet startup have in common? What ties them together? Really, and what David asked me to speak about is they all have great origin stories. And so, look, everyone in the room has a great origin story. Businesses generally have an origin story, but these three have great origin stories. And so the idea here for listeners and for those in the audience today is to ask ourselves, what can I seize on to drive me forward with the kind of energy and vision that's making these entrepreneurs so successful? So let's get started with Kylie. Are you ready?
Of course. First thing I want to say quickly, because I don't want to take this away, my co-founder is actually the CEO, not me. I don't want to take that away from her, but that's the one thing I'll say to start.
All right. Well, before that, because before we even got into the business, I was going to ask you, because I looked at videos of you from like 2015, and you were doing some crazy, crazy aerial stuff. So how did you get into that?
Yeah, that's a question I get asked a lot. So for context, I used to compete in the sport of freestyle aerials. So if you guys don't know that sport, it's basically where you're throwing yourself off of massive jumps, trying to do a bunch of flips and twists in the air and hoping to land on your feet, which is not always the case. But I competed in that sport for about 8 years professionally and went to the Olympics in 2018 in Pyeongchang, where I retired quickly after. But getting into that sport was definitely an interesting experience. I had never heard of it before trying it for the first time. One of my friends that I grew up with was actually the one that got me into the sport. So it was cool that me and him ended up actually going to the Olympics together. So yeah, I found the sport through a friend, and my parents just were excited to support me in that decision to try.
I don't know any parents who would support their kids doing that. All right. So beyond that. All right. So now the origin story. And I know you've told it before, this is a new audience. Tell us about how you go from being an Olympic freestyle skier to being the owner of Half Days.
Yeah, so my story really is based off my background and love for skiing. So I grew up skiing, started when I was 3 years old, and like I said, started competing professionally when I was 15. And really through that time of being a recreational skier to professional skier, I just really did not love the women's skiwear industry. what I tell people is when I was on the U.S. ski team, you know, we're sponsored by these brands that provide the team with uniforms that we wear, which is so amazing. And I was always very grateful for that. But at the same time, these huge brands would come to their athletes being like, what kind of feedback do you guys have? What changes do you want in the products that we're creating for you? And every year, all I asked for was a longer ski pant. I'm 5'9", so the pants were always kind of short on me. And, you know, I was wearing the same pant length as someone that was 5'1". And so I was like, how does that make sense? Can you please just make a longer pant? That's all I'm asking. And year after year, those changes were never made. And I ended up competing at the Olympics in that exact same uniform I was wearing 4 years prior. And so I kind of got to the point where I just felt like my voice was never going to be heard in this industry, especially if I was competing in the world's largest stage and they still weren't trying to satisfy our needs as athletes. And so when I retired from skiing, that was when I met my co-founder and CEO of the company, Ariana, and we both had the same experience with the women's ski industry and just the outdoor industry as a whole and never really feeling like we belonged. So that was kind of like long story short of how we came up with it.
Yeah, but so I get that you saw the problem. They wouldn't listen to you, but there's a big leap then, right? From going from having a problem to creating a brand. So how did that happen?
Yeah, so when I retired from skiing, I moved out to Denver a couple years later, and that was where I met my co-founder, Ariana. And after kind of bonding with her over our experience with the industry, and when she moved to Colorado, she kind of felt the same way, which she was a recreational skier, but had a really hard time shopping for ski wear, didn't really know where to start. And so we kind of chatted about it. She had always wanted to start a company. I had just retired from skiing professionally, so I wanted to take a break and really relax for a second. But when we came up with this idea, we decided to survey over 200 women who were also active in the outdoors and see if they felt the same way that we did. And lo and behold, they did. And so kind of right then and there, we knew that this was going to be a good idea, and that if we didn't start it, someone else probably would. So we kind of took the leap right away.
Well, the cool thing about what you do is that you can design clothing. You don't actually have to make it, right? So how did you find that journey? And I heard an interview with you where you actually had some serendipity around finding a manufacturer. But, you know, did you find some sense of comfort knowing that you didn't actually have to know how to make the stuff?
Yes and no. I think when we got into starting the company, we didn't realize how technical ski wear was and how hard it was to develop. And me and Ariana did not have any background in product development or design. So we really kind of took the leap with not knowing what to expect at all and quickly found out that ski wear is probably the most technical thing we could have chosen to make. So looking back, it was kind of crazy.
Why is that?
Why?
Yeah.
Because ski wear just has so many different parts to it. There's so many different trims and layers and fabrics and materials, and the list just goes on and on to be able to develop ski wear. And I mean, out of clothing, it's probably the hardest thing to create. And so we didn't realize that going into it, but we were really, really lucky with the people that we got introduced to, the factories that we met with, and the fabric vendors, and really were able to build such an amazing relationship with all of them that were able to help us take our idea to life, and also working with freelancers and contractors who actually did have the experience that we didn't and could help us take that vision to the end.
Yeah, I mean, so you had the idea that, okay, we're going to create a women's brand that fits properly, that women want to buy. How big was the leap between coming up with that notion and actually being able to have products for sale?
Yeah, so we started the idea of Half Days in September of 2019, and we launched the company in November of 2020. So that was about the time frame that it took for us to create the product. But keep in mind, those dates I just told you, COVID happened during that time. So like 3 months into starting the company, COVID happened, which obviously at the time felt like it was going to be detrimental to starting the company, but actually helped us in the long run because we were able to work with some factories that were working with these huge brands that were scaling back at the time. And so they accepted us, which they might not have if that wasn't the case. So in the grand scheme of things, we got lucky. Obviously, COVID was not great, but it definitely helped us for certain reasons.
So I always wonder, like, he found this great niche for women's clothing that wasn't being filled. And you asked, no one would answer. So you decided to do it yourself. And I always wonder, like, okay, so you did that. Now are those big name companies going to say, okay, now we see there's a need, we're just going to copy half days and kick your ass?
Yeah, great question. That's something that we did think of. You know, the second that we started launching our product, we were like, these other brands are going to see what we're doing and want to try to do it as well. But what we realized is that a lot of these large brands that have been around forever, it's really hard for them to make that pivot and make that transition. They're so well known for certain aspects that if they wanted to transition into doing what we were doing, it wasn't going to feel authentic to them. So we really did have this niche that these other brands couldn't really get into. And to this day, we hear from people that work at these companies being like, we want to do what you guys are doing, but we don't know how. So it's actually been really flattering. And I think we've been lucky in the fact that we are our customers. So for us and our audience, like, what we're doing feels authentic and they really trust our vision.
Do you think that some of it has to do with producing clothing for women, that there's an automatic sort of gravity that you're pulling in?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a couple aspects to it. It's us creating ski wear and other outdoor apparel for women, so it actually fits their bodies. It's in colors that and styles that they actually want to wear, which is hard to find with other outdoor industry brands, but it's also the community that we're building. So from day one, like I said, the outdoor industry is not super inclusive, and I've had such terrible experiences on the mountain myself, and we really wanted to make sure that with the brand, we weren't only creating great product, but also creating a community that was getting more women excited to be outdoors and feel like they belong.
Yeah. Was that part of your grand vision? But did you have a grand vision other than, like, let's make something we can sell and see what happens?
I think it happened so fast. We were excited to just have a brand and product at all. But I think once we realized that this thing was going to work for us, we quickly were like, okay, what can we do with this? How far can we take this? And, you know, we're constantly transitioning and changing our view for the future at the brand because it keeps growing and, you know, the options are kind of endless at this point.
Yeah. And I can't imagine, do you have any idea of what percentage of clothing brands that start succeed? Any idea?
Not off the top of my head, but I know it's not a lot. It's
right.
Low.
So what do you think was the difference between half days having success and the many who don't?
I think it really was us finding this niche that didn't exist. I think with ski wear, there were no other brands on the market that were doing what we were doing. And I think our audience just really connected with that. And I think it was something that they were looking for that they couldn't find.
Something I always wonder about when you hear new entrepreneurs talking about things, new ideas, there's something, I don't know what to call it, maybe friendly feedback. The idea that when you go share your idea with friends and family, they all say, oh, you're the most brilliant daughter in the world. What a great idea, blah, blah, blah. And you get all this wonderful feedback, right? But how do you know if you can believe it?
Oh, we didn't tell anyone about the company for a very long time. Not even our friends. We really didn't want to, one, jinx it, but talk about it too much. And if it failed, then we didn't want to feel like failures to the people around us. So we waited almost until the time of launch to really tell most people. Obviously, like, our family and closest friends did know after a few months questioning what the heck we were doing. But we definitely kept it a secret for a long time because we wanted to prove to ourselves before anyone else knew, like, we were going to put our all into this. And I think sometimes when you tell people you want to pursue something, they don't always believe you or like trust that you're actually going to put the time and effort that it takes. And, you know, a lot of companies fail. So I think we just really wanted to keep it to ourselves until we felt like we had something real before we introduced it to the world.
Well, and then when you introduced it, it wasn't in a big way, right? You were doing like, not farmer's market, but like trunk shows and things like that, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think as early stage founders, we were so hands-on with doing small pop-ups and bringing our products to every little event that we could so we could get it in front of people. But at the same time, we also had a feature in Vogue on the day of our first ever launch. So we actually were really lucky with the relationships that we had in our PR, and we were able to get it out to so many people from the very beginning. And I think that also helped us as well.
How did Vogue happen and PR?
Yeah, we got connected with just an amazing PR agency that believed in our vision and kind of were riding alongside us going through launch and just helped us get some really amazing connections.
You were paying for this, or did they just like you?
We were paying for it.
You were?
Nothing's free.
All right. So, all right. Just for this room, like, what kind of PR budget did you have to get Vogue and get, seriously, how much were you, because you were digging it. This was, you're setting a stake. You're saying we're going to do this.
I mean, it was small. I think a lot of people at the beginning question whether you need a PR agency or not. And we also questioned that as well. But we were willing to invest in it, knowing that if we could get features like Vogue at the beginning, that would take us to the next level. I think also our story was really amazing. And as an athlete, like, I also had the pleasure of being in Vogue when I was going to the 2018 Olympics. So I had a lot of connections from my previous life going into this one that I think helped with that as well.
Yeah. So how much?
That's a question for the CEO.
All right. I'm not going to ask it a third time. So
I don't know. Off the top of my head, I don't know.
All right. So last question, but then we're going to have a rotation here. And is Chris here?
Yes, everyone's
on. Good, Chris. Great. All right. So last question for you is, how did being an Olympic freestyle skier prepare you for the job you have now?
I get asked that question a lot. I think being a professional athlete and being a co-founder, there's a lot of similarities. One of the biggest things I say is not giving up on things. I think when I was an athlete, I was constantly, what I felt like, failing. If I performed poorly during a competition or didn't get the result that I wanted, it's so easy to be like, you know what, I'm done. Like, I've had enough. I'm going to move on. And with being a co-founder, it's the same thing. There's so many things that kick you down, knock you down, but you have to be okay with getting back up and trying again, or else you'll never get to the point you're trying to get to.
But there's physical pain.
Yeah,
involved.
And the physical pain does not exist anymore, thank God. Mentally, it's still there for sure.
Really? So, I mean, seriously though, like, when you're doing what you were doing as an Olympian, you were crashing and hurting. Is there any connection between that kind of physical pain and the kind of day-to-day stuff you have today?
No, I don't think so. I think falling on my back from like 30 feet in the air is a lot different experience than being a co-founder. But like mentally, I definitely go through a lot of the same ups and downs that I did being an athlete.
Nice. All right. Well, let's thank Kylie. We'll have her back in a minute. All right. Chris. Shifting gears to Chris with Radical. And so we'll start with your origin story. If you can give us I know you've done it. I've heard interviews with you doing it. But
sure.
Let's share your origin story, then we're going to dive in.
Happy to share that. I guess my origin and entrepreneurship began in 2002, where before I founded LawRhythm, really on a mission to bring companies better protection from very advanced cyber threats. Spent my career in cybersecurity and have had a thesis that there are bad actors in a lot of networks and I want to get them out of those networks. With Radicals, with LawRhythm, you mentioned that we sold that and ended up working out, which is good. And I thought I was retiring in, I guess, 2020, and spent some time off during COVID with my family, and then, you know, realized, one, I'm a builder and a creator, and there was things yet to innovate in the field of cyber that I want to see done, and I felt I could uniquely get done. I'm also a father, and I thought to myself, you know, not too much more time will pass before my boys will look at me and be like, my dad used to be this guy that did some amazing things. Now he's just, I don't know what he's doing now. And so I wasn't quite sure I'd be the role model I wanted to be for my boys by not getting back to work. So that also was part of my motivation. But what really got me fired up is in 2020, there was a hack called SolarGate. And in this hack, the Russians had compromised another vendor and gotten into their software distribution supply chain. And that software got deployed to thousands of companies across the globe. And that provided a backdoor into companies like Microsoft and U.S. Treasury. That backdoor wasn't discovered for 7 months. And the Russians were in the networks of some of the most important companies in the world, unbeknownst to anybody. And I thought to myself, if those companies who invest millions every single year in cybersecurity and have the best tech can't find a threat actor for 7 months, imagine what's happening to smaller businesses all across our country who have, you know, a millionth of the resources to apply to this problem. And that got me pissed, and that got me to start Radical.
Yeah. Well, and to be clear, the kinds of companies that probably are most at risk or of most concern aren't, you know, a mom and pop accounting firm or a retail store. These are like defense contractors supplying in, right? I mean, really highly proprietary kinds of content.
Yeah. I mean, you know, all these companies are at risk, unfortunately, and businesses can be wiped out. I mean, you can spend your life building an accounting firm and get ransomed and lose your brand and your reputation and be out of business. That's horrible. We are patriots, though. Myself and co-founders, we specifically are targeting companies in the defense supply chain for that reason, because they are being targeted by China, by Russia, Iran, etc. And our secrets, our inventions, are being stolen and exfiltrated out of our country, and showing up inventions and weapons pointed back to our country.
Thank you. I mean, we just spoke with Kylie, who's a first-time founder.
Yeah.
You've done this before.
Yeah.
So how did that shape sort of, even the way you tell your origin story has a different perspective than a first-timer, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, absolutely. You learn so much along the way. And for me, doing this again, it was, I had to do some deep thinking, because it is an all-in effort. It is very hard to build a company, and I am having done that, I was very cautious going back into it again, because I do have a family, and my wife really supported me in the first time around, and I don't want to put her through more than was fair to ask again and be there for my boys. But the same sense, I've tried to do things differently. I'm finding, though, that it's an all-in effort.
Is that even possible? Like, you know, you say, okay, I'm smarter. I've got more wisdom. I've got different priorities now. I want to focus on my family, and I'm going to do the startup a little differently than the last time. Is that even possible?
The effort, the sense of urgency, the difficulty doesn't change. I've gotten smarter in how I can approach things, how I can structure things, who I can put around me. And so I don't have to bear as much of the load myself. But it is not easy doing this. But it's also very fun. I mean, it's a great challenge to try to build something, create something, and have a team around you who's all trying to do the same thing with you.
Do you think it's more fun now because you've got a more mature perspective from your first time, your first go around? Like, I know you do everything yourself, or at least it feels like you're turning every knob yourself. So now, is it more fun because you can distribute some of that? You have better perspective, or no?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, it's fun this time. It was fun last time. First time around, I was writing software. I wrote software for probably seven, eight years, and I loved doing that. I was hoping to write software again. I haven't written a lick of code. Now I'm building financial models instead, and I'm thinking about how we're going to raise capital and build a team that can win.
Well, you told a story about your exit from Logarithm, which was financially quite successful, but you didn't feel all that fulfilled. Is that accurate, or that there was something missing?
Yeah, well, I felt fulfilled in terms of, what we built a great culture at Logarithm. The exit was very good for the investors. We did end up exiting to a private equity firm, and we dual path IPO versus private equity, and we ultimately determined the PE path was the better path for the investors. In hindsight, after we walked through that door, I'm not sure it was the best thing for the employees. And the legacy of the company and the product and the mission, just things change once you go down that path. And before that, to see to see your company in Times Square, we've got NYSE and NASDAQ courting you to list on their exchange, and to see your company in Times Square, and then not to go push that button or ring that bell, leaves a an itch you might want to scratch. And so this time around, I'd like to, get there and see if I can actually press that button.
Nice, cool. Yeah. When you decided to start Radical, you were 2 years into your sabbatical sort of thing, or time off from Logarithm.
Yeah.
however you call that, right?
Yeah.
Do you think
quasi retirement?
Yeah. Now, if something if something else had happened, you know, sometimes it's like timing. If did you just feel like it was time to get started on something new? Could you have just as well started a women's ski company or a supersonic jet business?
Oh boy. I don't think so. I really thought about I thought about doing an incubator or a startup lab. And I thought about starting a fund. Realized all of those to do them well still require material investment. You can't, you can't half-a that either. And I looked at that and kind of got back to you. Ultimately, I am a builder and I want to go create. And so that's the path I went.
Cool. How much of the fun that you talk about is because this time around you started Radical with your brother and with a good friend, which we know is super risky.
Yeah.
But talk about that.
Happy to. And I will say the other thing when I was in my quasi retirement is I was rapidly growing incompetent at all things in life. It's amazing, how I my boys would give me a hard time because I had this giant list of how I'm gonna do all these things. I'm going to build a treehouse. I'm going to build like rams for them. I got like hardly any of it done. And they still hold it against me. Dad, you're going to build that treehouse. What happened to the treehouse? I mean, I had like, almost 2 years off. I got nothing done. It was amazing. I don't even know. I've never where that time went to. It's incredible.
I'm guessing your wife would have an opinion about that.
She probably would. That's also probably contributed to why I'm back at work.
So have you got the treehouse built?
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
It's a treehouse. Too busy now.
All right. So talk about how you're viewing managing Radical differently from, now that you're CEO and you've got some maturity and some perspective, even some time off in between. How has your management and leadership style changed?
Well, it's been a journey. I've had a lot of personal, growth in terms of, becoming a good leader, investment executive coach, did that a lot of them, done it here as well. I think we all have things to learn there. And managing the stresses, of going through scale. And also it's stressful when your co-founder is one of your best friends and also your brother. And you cannot have any disruption to the nucleus of a founding team. And those relationships are critical. The advantage you have when it's your best buddy and your brother is you have implicit trust. And trust is so hard, is so important, and it's hard to create amongst people who you don't know. Are harder to, and so that foundation is important, but it can also, there's natural pressures on all of that. And so being very careful about that relationship, that core, is important, and also then surrounding ourselves with really exceptional people that align with our mission. We ask every new employee that comes to Radical, we ask one key question: are you a patriot and why? And we want to hear that, that answer and why they're a patriot, to make sure that they fundamentally care about the same things that we care about in terms of applying our talents towards protecting our nation.
So does having an inner circle that's your brother and your best friend, does that create a sort of it's them and then the rest of us mentality, or how do you manage around that?
Yeah, you could see that. We have a broader executive team now, though, and so as an executive team, we generally try to make decisions together. There are certain things we do as founders as well. But I think, we really try to keep not an us versus them mentality. It's team first. We're very transparent. We're very open. We all have open doors for anybody in the company. And I don't think anybody would kind of feel like, we're above anybody else.
Yeah. Talk about the role of bourbon and cigars in managing growth.
In managing growth, yeah. one of the ceremonies or traditions that we instantiated is we created Books and Smokes, where as founders we would pick a book on business or leadership, on building culture. And every Thursday we would go to one of our houses and we'd get a bottle of bourbon, some cigars, and we would discuss a few chapters of that book. And through that kept us close and kept us talking and also learning as well, learning from both the book and also from our shared experiences. And that's been a great vehicle, for us just staying close together and also advancing in our respective knowledge.
Yeah, that's cool. Any sort of seminal books that I'm putting you on the spot, but are there one or two that you think have most shaped the way you and your team think about the world?
Zero to One. was a we enjoyed that one a lot, and then Extreme Ownership was another.
That's by the Navy SEAL, right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Got it.
Jocko.
You also said, and this is my last question for you, and then Blake, wherever you are, there you are, Blake. Hi, Blake. You said just sort of at randomly, maybe, but never sell your company for stock. So talk about that.
I found out this lesson. I went to work for another entrepreneur, and he had sold his company to a public company for stock. This was 2001. He sold it for about $20 million, which back now is material money. And for him and for a lot of his team, they're about 25 people or so. And then I joined post acquisition. I think a year into it, that acquiring company had an SEC audit, or they'd been stuffing the channel. And that company's public stock went down by 95% in one day. And you can only imagine how deflating it is to be an entrepreneur where you sold your company for stock, and to have that stock you're holding you can't sell go from 20 million to 1 million. And then you, whatever percentage you had is even smaller. That was a very unhappy day. And so that sat with me, and I was like, I will never do that. Yeah.
Lesson learned from someone else. That's unusual.
For sure.
Yeah. All right. Well, hey, let's thank Chris. We'll see you again in a minute.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Chris. All right, Blake. Blake Scholes with Boom Supersonic. All right, we're starting every interview with the origin story. We're going to do that. I know you've told it before. I think it'll be great to ground us in that. And I got so many questions for you. Fire away.
So if anybody doesn't know the company, we're building supersonic passenger jets. And I do not have the resume at all for this. I went to school for computer science, and I went to Amazon in 2001 when my family was like, hey, we got you a computer science degree. Why are you working at a bookstore?
It happens a lot these days.
But flight's been my passion basically as long as I can remember. I started flying for fun in college, and in my 20s, I was up in Seattle. And of course, there's one of the Concords in the Seattle Museum of Flight. And I went on it and kind of remember thinking, like, why is the most amazing airplane ever made in a museum when there's nothing better in the sky? And so I set a lifetime goal of flying supersonic. I put a Google alert on supersonic jet, and I figured, like, I just want to be first to know when I could buy a ticket. And a decade went by, and it was basically crickets. There was no credible effort to pick up where Concorde had left off and to build anything better. And meanwhile, I'd had my Amazon career. I had been part of a couple different startups that had basically failed, including one that was a company I sold to Groupon that made a barcode scanning game. And when I was doing that first company, I would like wake up in the morning and think like, why am I doing this? If I like stack rank the most important thing in the world to the least important, I have to go get a backhoe and like dig a hole to find where like barcode scanning game would live. And yet, like, we all know what it's like to be an entrepreneur, right? Like, it's like chewing glass. And like, just because I knew mobile and e-commerce and, you know, I should be able to build this app, it didn't make it like any easier. And so when I had a chance to like really acquihire the company over to Groupon and like, you know, rest and vest for a couple of years, it was like my escape fantasy come real. And I went to like one rung up the ladder from like barcode scanning game to internet coupon. We know how it is. The founding bug had bit me. I wanted to found again, but I never ever wanted to get up in the morning and think, why did I do this? And is it worth the pain? And what I realized was, I think is the difficulty level in a startup is not set by the business. It's actually set by the founder, because I think we all have where our red lines are. And I know for me, I'm going to run up my red line no matter what I'm doing. But I can choose, there's almost like a money ball. I can choose to work on something more inspiring, and then it could be worth being at my red line versus another, random software thing. So I started organizing all my ideas by how happy I would be if it worked.
It's kind of brilliant.
Well, it worked out all right, and at least so far. But so basically that the concept was like, let me just optimize for my own motivation. And that it, for me, anything with an airplane, it went to the top of the list. And I thought I would have to, you know, I thought I would get 2 weeks into the research on supersonic and, you know, understand why it was a terrible idea that nobody else was pursuing. And then I'd move on, you know, confidently to the next thing. And I'd never have to worry about like being 80 and think like, what if I'd had the courage to look at the supersonic thing? So, long story short, what I expected to find like very obvious reasons that it was a terrible idea. What I instead found was that the internet was full of conventional wisdom about why you couldn't have high-speed flight that did not stand up to basic analysis that anybody with a spreadsheet, a web browser, and half a brain could do. And so I ended up spending a year basically learning aerospace engineering. And then kind of felt like I don't really understand how it is that I'm the human with this idea, but either I have no courage or I'm going to give it a run. And that was about 10 years ago that we hired our first people.
Wow. So I learned how to drive a boat on YouTube. I haven't seen any how to design a supersonic jet videos on YouTube. So seriously, like, I think this is important for everybody in the room. Like, what made you think you could actually do it?
I didn't think I could do it. One of my premises is that the only way I could find my limits was to pick the most motivating thing in the world and just give it everything I've got and see how far I could get. And I sort of didn't expect to get nearly as far as we've actually gotten.
If you had to think back on that day you decided you wanted to try it because it was the most motivating thing you could think of, what percentage odds of success would you have given yourself?
It was very low. I don't know. It was probably like epsilon more than zero. I really struggled with the decision because I was going to go tell my friends I'm going to build a supersonic jet, and it's like you could just like watch the eyes roll back.
You put an aluminum foil hat on,
right? Like one of my closest friends said, "All right, Blake, like, you call me back when you got something less pie in the sky." And I remember for a while, the project code name was Pie because the goal was to get the pie in the sky. But it was, you know, like, it was very, like, I have this very complicated relationship with my own ego on this. And I remember thinking about the entrepreneurs I really admire. And in particular, I thought of Bill Gates. And Gates, I think in the 70s, had said that his goal was to put a computer on every desk and in every home running Microsoft software. And he said that in the 70s, right? And then he did that and a bunch of things well beyond that. But Gates didn't have the resume to do it. Heck, he didn't even have a resume. And yet he had the courage to go make that declaration. What was it like to be Bill Gates? Like, he had to be willing to throw himself into something big. Well, in his heart of hearts, he knew it was nowhere close to guaranteed. And so they're like, when the people who like take on big missions and succeed, like, we know their names. You know, it's Gates and it's Jobs, and back in the day it's Thomas Edison. You know, the greats of the great. And I think there's also like a dark matter of founders. And they're the people who take on big things and for whatever reason it doesn't work. And I sort of made the conscious decision that I would much rather be a dark matter entrepreneur than I didn't try entrepreneur.
Wow. So everyone must have said you're crazy who knew what you were doing, right? Everyone did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mostly. I mean, there was one guy who told me to go for it.
Who was that?
Avichal Garg. He's sort of well known now because he started Electric Capital. This is before he had started Electric. And I remember he had just sold a company to Facebook. We were like hanging out at the Facebook like cafeteria. I told him the idea and why I thought it could work. And he says, "Blake, you just need to go do this. It makes sense." And years later, he told me he thought I was completely crazy, but he could tell I was so excited. He just didn't have it in his heart to tell me not to do it.
Oh, God, how funny. Well, now you've raised about $700 million. Is that roughly an accurate number?
It's six to seven, somewhere in that range.
Somewhere in that range, right.
I've lost count a little bit.
A guy who does what you do should be able to keep track, but that's
oops.
All right.
Yeah.
So what did you tell investors? Like, I'm going to build a supersonic jet. I've never done it. I don't know how, and I hope it works. Like, how does that pitch go?
Not like that wouldn't have gone well. people often ask me, like, how do I have any credibility in the space? And I think there's no substitute for actually knowing what you're talking about. And so, like, I spent a year learning it for myself. And a thing I've come to believe is, like, great people don't hire experts and delegate. Great people find experts and use the experts as teachers. And so the first thing I did was I built a spreadsheet model of airline economics. So I actually had looked at starting an airline, and so I understood the fundamental drivers of airline economics. And then, you know, I was like, okay, I got to look at supersonic. Okay, so great. So I went all the way back. I took remedial calculus and physics because I hadn't had any since high school. I bought every aerospace textbook I could find. I read them. If I couldn't understand it, I threw it out, got a different one. Took an airplane design. I mean, there's just no substitute for getting to enough knowledge that when someone asks a question, like, I confidently know the answer.
So do you think in a year you were maybe one of the world's foremost experts on supersonic flight? I mean, that's what it sounds like. You crammed into it.
It's
yeah.
It's kind of a mind fuck to say that. Sorry, can I say that here? But it's one of the things that really surprised me is, like, how easy it actually is to skate to the frontiers of human knowledge. Like, we tend to get taught that, like, the big important things in the world have, like, great people who are on them and have studied them for years and have 15 PhDs. But it's actually, like, shockingly easy to discover the things that all the quote-unquote experts have missed. Like, it took 2 weeks to have the key idea. The key idea is, if you beat Concord by about 10% in fuel economy, you can make a supersonic seat with the economics of a flatbed in business class. But the flight's so fast, you don't need the bed. That's the idea. That's it. Somehow, no one else had found that.
Hmm. Wow. Now, one thing that the audacity of the amount of money that it takes to actually try this before you even know it's going to work, in most, you know, most entrepreneurs in the room, most people we talk about, you know, they've got a minimal viable product that costs thousands or maybe six figures or, you know, but you have to build a jet that flies before that's your minimum viable product, right?
Yeah, this is why pre-orders matter.
This is why what?
Pre-orders matter.
Pre-orders, yes.
Right? Like the, you know, you can kind of sort of think about businesses in along two axes. Like one is like how much capital does it require to try the idea? And the other axis is like how obviously a good idea is it? And the vast majority of successful, like, you know, internet companies, the companies have been created over the last few decades in tech, are clustered in the doesn't sound, not very obviously a good idea, but also really cheap to try. Like open an app on your phone and summon a stranger from the internet to give you a ride, right? Like, not obviously a good idea, but really cheap to try. eBay, I think, is also the category.
Like, Airbnb, lots of, let's put a mattress
Airbnb,
in our bed, yeah.
Right? Like it's you know, invite strangers from the internet to sleep on your couch. Like, this doesn't sound like a good idea, but it's cheap to try. So supersonic jets, I think, is in this category of it's actually not that hard to make it really obvious that it's a good idea. I think at a certain level, like, intuitively, we all want faster flights. But Concord missed. It missed on product market fit. You know, $20,000 ticket, 100 uncomfortable seats. You can't fill the seats. It doesn't fit the airline economic model at all, especially not in the 1970s. So what we had to go do is find a capital light way to prove that if we built what we set out to build, that there was definitely a large market for it. Getting LOIs early mattered. Getting United to make a deposit mattered. Getting American to make a deposit mattered.
So what kind of deposits? Are these deposit sizes big enough that they're important for you, but small enough that the risk for these companies is, like, not that big of a deal?
Basically.
Yeah.
You sort of have to find there's, like, some, you know, sort of Venn diagram, right, of, like, deals that are useful to us and, like, deals the counterparty will do. And then you have to find the overlap and do the deal, right?
Yeah.
The most surprising thing in all of this was that, like, airlines would actually do these deals before we'd ever flown anything.
Wow. All right. So is there some secret sauce in the presentation that you found resonated with them?
We got to find the right customer at the right time in their history. So timing mattered. Like, the very first one we did was Virgin. And There's a whole story of like how I got to Branson, but I got to Branson and kind of told him what we were doing and why. And this is what we were, this is like during Y Combinator. And like, I was like trying to get some kind of a deal done before demo day. And he sort of leans back in his chair and he's like, oh guys, this is like brilliant. Like, I love it. But like, I'm already doing like one of these things with Virgin Galactic. And I don't know if I could like do two. I said, Richard, I'm not asking for your money. I'm asking, when this works, would you like the first 10 to have a Virgin logo on the tail, not a British Airways logo? Because if you'll raise your hand and say, this makes sense and I want it, I'll get all the money somewhere else. I don't need a penny from you. And you know, if you know anything about Branson, like you know his like favorite thing is to stick it to BA. So we let William stick it to BA, and the deal got done on an email.
Wow! So that was really what he was buying, was sticking it to British Airways in a way.
Right. So sometimes there's like a very strange way to package what we're selling to turn it to the thing that the other party wants. Like, so the next deal we did was Japan Airlines, and basically we sold Japan Airlines insurance against our own success. Okay, what does that mean? We went to them and basically said, okay, what percentage of your business comes from business class? And they're like, well, it's only 20% of seats, but it's like half the revenue and about 80% the op profit. Okay. You guys know those passengers. Do you think they'd switch airlines for flights twice as fast? And they're like, oh yeah. Yeah, totally they would. Like obviously they would. Okay. Well, what would happen to your business if ANA had this and you didn't? And they're like, oh shit! Like we wouldn't just lose our international business, like, because people switch all their other domestic flying too, and we'd have to become like a low cost airline. We'd be lucky to survive that. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, sign here. You do it to them.
Nice. All right, last question, and then I'll ask our others, Chris and Kylie, to come on up. Ankur, if you can grab some chairs. Last question for you, which is that there was a time when you had 3 weeks cash left. Regardless of what Richard Branson did and all that stuff, you had 3 weeks of cash left. Can you tell a story about how you got through that?
Well, there was 2 more weeks before we got any more money.
Ah, one week.
We got into 7 days of cash. I don't recommend this. I kept telling the team at the time that there are some things that are more fun to tell stories about later than they are to live through. And so here we go. I should tell the story, I guess. Things had taken longer than we wanted to get to key milestones. The market sucked, and like every attempt we'd made to go like raise around had basically failed. And I remember calling. I called Paul Graham when we were at 3 weeks. I said, "Paul, we've got 3 weeks of cash. I need some advice." And a whole series of things happened, but basically PG saved the company. It was part of a group of people who managed to put what ended up being a very successful round together. And, we ended up raising $150 million of fresh capital, put a whole bunch of runway back on the balance sheet. I don't recommend that.
I bet that felt good though. But seeing that $150 in the bank,
it felt a little better. Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
it got done right as we broke the sound barrier, and then like all kinds of things happened. Yeah.
Wow. And too bad you couldn't celebrate with a loud boom.
Right. Like I wanted to call it the boom heard around the world, but it was actually the boom heard by nobody.
Yeah. I mean, that's really one of your improvements, is that your planes do not create a sonic boom.
Yeah. That was actually not the original plan. We had, our original plan had been, we're going to fly supersonic over water, subsonic over land, like solve the sonic boom thing another day. And yet there's this like well-known physics that people have talked about for a long time called Mach cutoff, which basically like if you it's really software. If you fly the airplane at the right speed and altitude for the day, the boom will never reach the ground. But we looked at it when we were buying other people's engines, and it basically just didn't work. The engines weren't powerful enough to do it. And so we kind of shelved the idea. And meanwhile, like we had this like famous breakup with Rolls-Royce. We started building our own engines, started optimizing our own engines. And I go to the engineering status meetings, and it was like, oh, transonic performance keeps getting better. And we're like, huh, that's interesting. And then we did our first supersonic flight, and sort of by happenstance, we did it in the boomless condition without really trying. And I'm on Twitter, and like the whole internet is like, well, the whole reason this company exists is to solve sonic boom. And I like couldn't convince people that was actually not the whole point. And then I was thinking, wait a minute, the engine numbers just keep getting better. So I called an emergency engineering meeting on a Saturday, and I was like, guys, we got to rerun the math. Because with the new engines, can we actually fly in boomless condition? And it took about 90 minutes, and they're like, yeah, it actually just works.
Cool. So that was one of these old – come on up, please. That was one of these old problems with the Concorde was the noise. But
yeah.
All right, next question, and I've got Chris and Kylie back here with me. I want to talk about this notion. Kylie, you and I talked about it a little bit, so I'm going to continue the conversation with you about it. But then for all of you, and then if you've got questions, I've got a couple, but Ankur's going to be here too. Ambitious vision can sort of be blinding. You know, you hear all these stories, and you both, maybe all three of you said, no one's doing this, right? Most of the time when entrepreneurs say, no one's doing this, or who's your competition? I don't have any competition. It's nonsense most of the time. Other times, you know, you hear the comment, you know, the market is X billions of dollars. If I could just get 1%, right, then boom, we're off to the races. So let me talk about this notion of ambitious vision versus fantasy, maybe. So,
you want me to go first?
Sure.
That's a tough question to answer. I think, yes, I said we found this niche when it came to women's ski wear, but obviously, there's a million other competitors that exist in the market. So for us, it was really understanding how we could set ourselves apart from what everyone else was doing. And we're constantly trying to understand how to acquire new customers and how to get customers to come to us instead of these other brands and convince them why we're doing is better than what these other brands are doing. But it's a struggle every day. I mean, it's not like it's coming super easy. I think from the beginning, yes, we were lucky that a lot of people were excited about what we're doing, but every day we're fighting and trying to get more people to be excited about the brand.
Thank you. All right. Chris, question for you. Can a great origin story threaten to sort of lock you into strategies that you might be better off pivoting from at some point? Actually, I could ask any of you that question, but yeah.
Yeah, if you're so locked into your origin story, living out your origin story, that's probably going to be a problem. If, you know, the conditions in the market or what you learn along the way don't align with what you're hell-bent on doing. I think good entrepreneurs find a way to pivot, you know, into that same origin story. You know, might not be manifested, that mission, that vision they have may ultimately be manifested a bit differently based upon what they find in the market. But they're still most often finding a way to realize and manifest that vision.
You think so?
I'll say a couple of things. I think one of the biggest mistakes made by smart people is to not notice when context changes. And so I try to hold a lot of awareness for myself. I try to teach the team to like remember where our conclusions came from. Because if something, like think of it as like a big complex spreadsheet. And if like someone changes the assumption in cell A1, do you like remember to refresh all the other cells? And like the story I was telling about Boomless for us was like this. It was like we discovered in early February that like we'd stumbled across a solution for Sonic Boom that was practical. And we like completely changed the strategy of the company, and everyone thought we planned it that way. And just, I think you just have to notice, you have to know where your origin story really came from. And if something in the assumptions changes, then you can totally like embrace it, and you can notice it quickly.
For any of the three of you, has your initial vision changed as you've matured in the company's development, the company's growth? You're nodding, Kylie, but to all of you, right? Does your vision change, and should it?
Huh. I was just going to say, I think that our vision has stayed the same since day one, but I think understanding how to pivot is really, really important. When we first started Half Days, our vision was very locked in on doing ski wear specifically. That was kind of all we wanted to do from day one, and quickly found out that we couldn't live as just a seasonal brand selling ski wear a couple months out of the year. So we've since really understood how we could, you know, create categories outside of just ski that are also resonating with our customers. But really, it's just understanding that every single day is different and how we can pivot and change with the market or what people are expecting out of us as a brand. And so really just being able to stay on your toes is really important.
Yeah, I would say I'd probably break a lot of, you know, modern thinking around entrepreneurship, kind of the, you know, the MVP, build something small, get it fast to market as fast as you can, get feedback, iterate. You know, both paths I've been on has been an audacious, grand platform vision, but with a planned incremental see realized over many years. Now, minor pivots along the way, certainly, but going after something that is bigger, comprehensive, and grander, and having faith that, you know, you can get there, and also making sure you're building value along the way, because ultimately you've got to go serve a customer.
Yeah, I went back recently and read this thing, a manifesto I wrote in 2014, and it felt like I'd written it yesterday. Like the original vision really did stand the test of time, but the concrete manifestation of it is completely different than what I thought it would be. So it's like I always was going to bake a cake, but the cake I'm baking is, you know, it's the flavor has changed and the shape has changed, and lots, you know, we added some layers and all that stuff.
Does anybody have questions out there? Because be happy to hear them. I've got one more.
Yeah, please.
Oh, come on up, please, and hop on the mic. While you're doing that, I'll ask this question. You mentioned, Chris, about involving customers, and I'm wondering if all three of you, as you mature in the path that your company's taking and you pivot and you do other things, are you including the customer in that journey with you? Do they know that you're doing these things? There's some value in having the customer understand the gyrations of your operations.
Well, for us specifically, our customers are heavily involved in almost everything that we do. We're actually planning right now a bunch of different customer interviews and insights that we're going to be performing the next few weeks and months. And so we really want our customers to feel like they are a part of our brand. Their feedback we really take into account. And I think that goes back to me feeling like my feedback wasn't heard. And so I want to make sure that what we're doing really feels like our customers have a voice and have a say in the things that we're creating. But I think it might be different just because for us, like, our customers are so important to us as far as our community, like I was talking about before. But yeah, they're very heavily involved in every decision that we make, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably true for a lot of founders. I mean, when you're building something and creating something, you're creating it for yourself, where you are kind of, you're building what you would want. And so that drives a lot of your innovation, your creativity, and how you see that realized. What you also have to do as a founder is go sell. You've got to go sell that vision, sell it to investors. You've got to go sell it to prospects and land deals. And you're going to get feedback. You're going to hear things along the way. And you're going to have to also tailor that feedback to the various audience. From a customer, a investor perspective, and also an buyer perspective. And so it's pretty hard not to get some feedback you're going to listen to and want to listen to.
We have it's sort of complicated for us because we have our direct customers are airlines, but it's always been my view that our real customers are passengers, and it's a very different view than you get out of like a Boeing. And so we deliberately stay very close to passengers, and we try to listen to the airlines in the right way, because some airlines really understand the passengers, and some like, oh boy.
Not naming them though, right? No.
No, I can't name them. It would be way more fun. So we try to sort of with airlines, we try to say, what do they know that we don't know that we need to learn? And it's that same sort of idea of don't delegate to experts, learn from experts.
All right, question, your name and
your question, please.
Yeah, my name is Charlie, and thank you guys all for being here. Blake, my question's for you. No pun intended, but how do you sort of stay grounded, right? You've raised a lot of money from prominent investors, have a lot of media coverage. What you're building sort of speaks to the ability of U.S. engineering. So when you sort of look forward of build what you're building, how do you just stay grounded and stay focused on the mission?
I think this is going to sound really obvious. Like just come to the office every day and see all the freaking problems we have to solve and work on them. Like there is a mountain of hard work to be done, and I enjoy working on it with the team. I don't know if that's helpful, but
no, thank you. Yeah. I appreciate it.
Hey, do you have any advice, especially from your personal experience, of how to mitigate damage from, say, a down round?
We just told the whole world we did it. Like you know, we like reporters were sniffing around about it, and I could tell there's going to be some like gotcha story that would come out. And we talked about it. Ultimately, I was like, we're just going to do what I called the flush the toilet strategy. So I just went on Twitter and I was like, hey, we raised a bunch of money from some great people. But by the way, it was a really terrible round. Here we are. And then the news story became, oh, wasn't it interesting that they chose not to hide it? And so we got like additional publicity out of the choice to talk about it. So I think just own it. And like, I remember I was interviewing with the information for their story about it. And I was like, public stocks go up and down. Why is it a big deal if a private stock goes up and down? Like, what matters is the end story.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Did you have a comment, David?
No yeah. experience, and I hope to avoid it.
We're going to steal a couple of minutes here, but
on the team today, we are one direction only, and that is growth.
My question was just going to be, I'd love to hear from each of you, like, what is, you know, you're all obviously extremely ambitious. What does success look for like for you in these businesses right now and for you personally?
I want supersonic flight to not be special because it's how we all travel and people take it for granted.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for me, you know, we're trying to transform, cybersecurity into AI. This thing called the Security Operations Center, or SOC, which is now, you know, staffed by lots of skilled people. It's essential, but they operate at human speed. Threats of the future will no longer operate at human speed. They need to operate at machine speed. And for me, I want to see that AI SOC being instantiated and feel like I had a meaningful part in seeing that that technological transition occur, because it's a necessity, and it's what I've been going after for 25 years now. So, and then along the way, having fun, being a good husband, being a good dad, and enjoying
building
the ride.
A treehouse.
The treehouse is not coming, but we have a lot of fun together, though. So,
my answer is a lot more simple, I would say. But for me, it's just to get more women outdoors. That's like my number one thing with half days. Is if we can get more women outdoors, it's a success for me, and fun. Yeah, I would say if you're not having fun, then you're not doing it right.
All right, we've got one more question.
I wonder if you could tell us what it's like today to raise additional funds and what challenges you're facing. What are your techniques and solutions for new entrepreneurs to raise more money?
Well, we're about to find out. We're just kicking off our Series A. 3 months ago was probably the most nervous I've been as a entrepreneur, and there's many up and downs, a lot of them. Although it was mostly up, we had a good ride. We were not where I wanted to be revenue wise. And set an audacious goal for the team to get over $1 million in ARR in the next, in the next 2 months. We were at 500 and we did it. So now we're, now we're north of $1 million ARR, 1.3 in 15 months, and we've gone from feeling we're not where we need to be, it's now being in a rare class of performance and going out to raise a Series A. We'll see, how that process goes, though. So far, we're at RSA, 2 weeks ago, and the feedback's good because we've got good metrics, and we'll see in July if we get some good term sheets. But I will say it's very different in the like pre-revenue stage of things versus post-revenue, and just kind of the messaging that we're getting. I think the sensitivity of the investors and the class of investor And so far, you know, it's been positive. More work to do.
Kylie?
Well, lucky for me, my co-founder is the one that does all the fundraising, but I've spoken with her a lot about it, and I do know how difficult it's been for her. But one of the things she always says to me is forward momentum over everything. So if the first person says no, move on to the next. The amount of no's that we've gotten is insane, but we've also gotten a lot of yeses as well. So being able to move past those no's and find the people that do believe in what we're doing and that want to say yes, and finding the right partners, I think is really important as well. And the people that believe in what we're doing and want to see us succeed and help build the company alongside us.
If I had to just pick one thing, I'd say construct a plan such that I am like thoroughly convicted for the right investor, it's actually a smart investment. And if I don't believe that, if the plan's not good enough, I need to work on the plan until it is good enough. And then the fundraising job is really a communication job. It's not like a sales job, or maybe all sales jobs, if you're selling the right thing, are just communication jobs.
Well, it certainly is about fit more than anything. So, all right.
A big part of it is fit, for sure, I would say. You know, you really understand the fit, you know, what you're seeking to raise, the funds you're going into, you know, the check size. It really all comes down to math. Is the math going to work? Do they believe in your idea? And then does the math work? Because you can find belief, but the math economics might not work out. So make sure you know the math models.
All right. I'm getting the nod here. All right, this is it for this special episode of ProCo 360. Guests today were Kylie McKinnon of Half Days, Blake Scholl of Boom Supersonic, and Chris Peterson of Radical. And by the way, thanks to our friends Denver Ventures and, of course, to our live audience here today. There you go. Thank you. Yep. Appreciate David, Ankur, and Amy of Denver Ventures. Sean over here in the corner has been sitting here quietly helping us make sure you can hear me. It's been great fun. This is ProCo 360, Live, Work, Love, Colorado.